This is Michelle Anderson, north of Bangor, and this is the second half of my interview with Senator Peter Mills. Senator Mills is running for governor for the state of Maine, and we met and had coffee on April 16th at the Country Diner in East Millinocket. At the end of the first half of the interview, Senator Mills was explaining why he was the only Republican who voted for LD 1495. In the second half, he continues.
It does have some good tax. I mean, it does increase the tax on food and lodging and on food and lodging. And about half of those taxes are paid by people who visit here or don't live here. I understand the other half are paid by me and you and people who live here. But at the very least, it had the effect of transferring some of that tax burden to the out-of-staters, and the income tax benefits, the income tax cuts in the bill are almost exclusively for people who are Maine residents, so it had an impact of shifting taxes to people outside. So for a lot of reasons, I thought it was a better tax law than the one that we presently have, and that's why I supported it then, and I continue to support it now.
Well, would there be a problem with going one way or another, abolishing the income tax and relying solely on a higher tax? Because it's scary because now you've got two systems where either one is apt to raise stuff on you instead of just the one that you have to watch.
I would dearly love to abolish the sales, the income tax, rather, if I could afford to, if the state could afford to. I think that people have much less concern about sales taxes because it's a tax that's imposed when you choose to have it imposed. When you choose to buy a new car or buy building materials and you pay the 5%, that's part of your cost decision. So, sure. And there's a big national movement toward a fair tax, which would get rid of the U.S. income tax and impose fairly substantial sales tax. People differ on how much it would have to be, but somewhere between 25% and 30%, as I recall. It's quite a lot of tax, but the virtue of it is that it would be a little easier to collect it at the point of sale, and a little easier to administer, and you could get the IRS out of our hair. All of that would be a good thing, but I think it would be difficult for either the state or the federal government to try to run entirely on consumption taxes. I'd like to see us make progress in that direction.
Okay. What about LURC? Do you have any thoughts on LURC?
Yeah, I think that the I served for 4 days last year at this time on a group that was a group of landowners, big and small, and environmental people, and some public officials, people who served on the LURC board, a whole host of us. There were about 25 or 30 of us, and we met for 4 days to try to mediate some of the differences that were arising in developing the new comprehensive land use plan for the North Woods, the so-called CLUP, which comes up every 10 years for renewal. I can't tell you that process was particularly successful, except that it did bring an awful lot of people from opposing ends of the political spectrum into one room and to allow them to come to some understanding of each other. What I learned from it is that the current rules for zoning the North Woods are so uncertain and in some cases so vague that development is stymied, at least for that reason, if no other. We certainly saw that with Plum Creek. The people that administer LURC had come up with this zoning program called the concept plan, which would say to a large landowner, you come in and tell us what you would like to do within certain performance specifications. Take your land, set aside, take a big plot of land, as Plum Creek did, 400,000 acres plus. Set aside some of it for forestry and recreation. Tell us where you want to put the recreational trails. Tell us where you want to put your houses and development and your resorts. And create your own zones. You know, wow, that sounded like a good idea. Well, no sooner did they come forward with that huge chart that showed where all their proposed zones were for the next 30-odd years, and it generated a firestorm of resistance and controversy from many sectors. And over four years of litigation. But I'm afraid that it's very doubtful that any other landowner will come forward in that way again because of the expense and the difficulty that Plum Creek went through in trying to get their plan approved. I think there's great merit to the concept plan in giving the landowner some freedom to lay out his case. And I think perhaps what needs to happen, I think what does need to happen is that the whatever we set out as performance or result specifications need to be a little clearer, need to be a great deal clearer, so that the landowner can know just how much land has to be set aside, how much land has to be devoted to recreation and forestry, and how much of it he's allowed to put forward for development purposes, and roughly where. But the standard, all of those standards are so uncertain in the current law that it's all open to you would like to say it's all open to discussion. What it is it's all open to controversy.
Right.
And controversy costs money. One of my friends tried to get a project through LIRC some years ago, and he said, I didn't mind so much when they told me no. I wish they'd told me no $1 million earlier, and I wouldn't have wasted my time.
That's the problem.
So,
during the whole club, the run-up to the club, mm-hmm. there was a lot of talk up here about trying to change our government over to a county form of government as opposed to what it is now. Have you given, I think there was even something that was proposed to go through the legislature. Have you given any thoughts to anything like that?
Well, the proposal was to take the counties, the six, I think there are six counties that have a lot of UT land in them, or have most of it. The thought was to take counties like Somerset and Piscataquis and Penobscot and turn the zoning function over to county government. The people in southern Maine have, many of them have grave concerns about that because they think they own part of the Northwoods as much as we do up here. And it was a substantial political challenge to get a bill like that even off the ground. I don't think it's practical to consider it because I just don't think you could get it through the House of Representatives. However, it would be highly appropriate, I think, to give county government a stronger say in what happens. And in order for people to agree to that, I think we have to consider how to reform county government so people will trust county government. People don't trust it.
They don't trust the state government very much either, so
no.
I guess you're almost in a trouble putting that.
But county government is particularly shackled by traditions that go back way beyond 1820.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tradition that the county commissioners will themselves manage, or at least the number one commissioner, the chairman, will manage the affairs of county government. That was the old system, very much like the old three-member selectman system where we did our town. But every large town in Maine now, almost all of them, have gone to a five- or seven-member board, town council, city council, with a professional administrator, and the administrator does a lot of the hiring and firing and management of the money, and the council serves as a board of directors. Well, county governments are slowly heading that way. I just served on a charter commission for Somerset County. We're proposing to go from three to five commissioners and allow them to with the permission of the public, to take on a little broader role. But it's common practice now in county government to elect not only the sheriff, but the register of deeds, the register of probate, the treasurer. You have to ask yourself, what is there about why is the registry of deeds viewed as a political opportunity? There's no discretion really in that job. What you want is a very competent person who knows how to manage a fairly large office, but it has no political discretion. There's no policy making in it. You either do the job well or you don't do it well.
Right.
And same with probate. So these are people who ought to be hired on their merits and not regard to their political affiliations or with regard to how many signs they can put up in October. So we need to, and then you have the whole question of how does county government decide to, how do we impose taxes? It used to be that the taxes of county government were established by the legislature, of all things. I participated in that back in 1994 and 5 when Kennebec County was still doing it, and I represented a piece of Kennebec. Well, all of the counties now, I think every one of them now, has a budget committee that's where the towns are sort of represented, and the budget committee is put into a sort of tension with the county commissioners, and the two camps go back and forth until they've hammered out a budget. I don't know if that system works all that well, but I think it's probably better. It's certainly better than the one that we had. But if we could figure out a way of causing people to have more confidence in how county government is managed and run, I can think of a number of things that county governments would be doing better than many of the towns can do. I mean, public works, for example. Why is it that, you know, when you drive down Route 9 or Route 2, every 6 miles is a different town garage, and inside of every town garage there's a grader, and the grader is idle. I'm not sure that's... I believe in local control, but I'm not sure I believe in local graders. I think we should... Towns are getting squeezed badly because people don't want to pay property taxes, and you can't blame them. And yet they want those local services. I don't know how else to provide them effectively, certainly in the public works arena, without encouraging the towns to join forces with each other, maybe not at the county level, but maybe on a regional level. There is a downside to that. If you let those departments of public works become large and ungainly, then they become as inefficient as maybe the state is. So, and it brings up a topic we just talked about 10 minutes ago, and that is the state. I talk to DOT workers, and I say, look, if you can make the case that doing repairs or road building, or certainly plowing and so on, if state employees can do it on a basis that is, you know, even reasonably competitive with the cost of having it contracted out, let's compare costs. And people in state government need to be prepared to justify their costs and the results that they achieve, just like everybody else.
Right.
Otherwise, taxpayers are going to become increasingly unhappy and angry, and the tea parties will get bigger. And so my challenge to state workers and state administrators is, come forward with the evidence. Help to design the systems by which the evidence of your achievement, your goals, your results will be freely open to people, preferably on the web, so that people can understand
where the money's going.
And whether there are inefficiencies or not. I mean, and you know, sometimes the case is so apparent that people get disgusted. This is a sore point for some people, but we closed down the state liquor stores a few years ago because people were being paid $10 or $12 an hour and getting a state pension for taking a bottle and sticking it into a paper bag and smiling at you. And we get that done at Hannaford Brothers and Rite Aid for a whole lot less. Maybe it's not fair, but the state really had no business managing liquor stores. We have a similar situation with Dorothea Dix Hospital. It's in a horribly inefficient building. The number of people that are required to take care of those deeply disturbed patients far exceeds the national average. It's not proving out as a cost on a cost basis, and we need to, if not close it greatly, we need a new building, or they should be consolidated with Riverview. But I mean, there are these places that stand out in state government where costs are very, very high and not systematically looked at. So if there are efficiencies, if there are bureaus and departments in state government that view themselves as highly efficient, let's come forward with the evidence. I believe in a government based on evidence and accountability. And you don't see that very often.
No, you don't. I have one more question. The railroad.
Yeah.
The bond package for the railroad. What are your thoughts on that? I'm not even sure how you voted, Peter.
Well, I gave it a skeptical yes. And I can say that with some forthrightness, because I spent the weekend before that vote writing up about a dozen different conditions that I thought ought to be included. If the state is going to put up some money, my position was that we ought to go at this as a business deal and not on the basis of our emotions. I said, I'm very personally, emotionally committed to keeping it open. I would love to see it kept open. My mother grew up on that in Ashland, Maine. She and her ancestors were dependent on that rail line for moving potatoes out of the county and lumber and lots of other things. So it represents a way of life and is a support for various means of livelihood in Aroostook County that are crucial. But on the other hand, this is a railroad that's gone bankrupt two or three times in the last 30 years, ever since the bang on Aroostook first went under. And we have to ask ourselves whether this thing is viable. And the state shouldn't just plunge in on the basis of our emotions. So I wrote down a number of conditions. This thing is a deal with many moving parts. The shippers, there are 22 of them. The shippers have a stake in it, probably the biggest stake in it. We need a third-party operator, probably some operator other than Montreal, the present operator. And the state is a party to it. And, of course, you have the surface transportation people in Washington that will oversee the rates and that sort of thing. I think the right-of-way, taken as a whole, is probably worth a lot more than the sum of its parts. Liquidation value for railroading purposes is what you get if you sell it off to the abutters. But clearly, the coherent right to get to have a piece of property that's 240 miles long and 90 feet wide through towns and forests and across highways, that's a very valuable right all by itself, so that it's probably worth two or three times its liquidation value. So there is a good reason for the state to step in and make sure that that property isn't abandoned, and that the... But I thought that the state should not have to pay any more for it than the liquidation value. Well, anyway, my work, the language and the conditions that I wrote before we passed the bill were incorporated, many of them were incorporated in the governor's order that was issued a day or two after we passed the bond bill. And the state, my main position is that if we can't put the deal together in a way that makes sense from the state's own business perspective, then we should walk away from it. And just because we have the authority to go borrow some money and put it into this project of buying the railroad doesn't mean that we have to do it. Only if the rail line itself is cooperative, and if the shippers are cooperative, and the pieces come together, and we get some federal funds to help fix up the rail, when all of those things come together, then the state's money should also come in. But not until we're satisfied that the deal is viable.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for coming out.
I'm glad to be here in Millinocket.
And I will be probably calling your office again for another interview.
All right. You're very good.
Thank you.
Well.